This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Looking Glass Books, an independent and eclectic bookstore proud to be a partner with KABU in the free exchange of ideas. Looking Glass is located at 318 Southwest Taylor in downtown Portland. For information, the number is 503-227-4760. It's 9 o'clock, and welcome to the Tuesday Radio Zine on KBOO Portland. First, we join host Per Fogering for a special program featuring an extended interview with John Perkins, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Perkins is a former respected member of the international banking community. He says he helped the U.S. cheat poor countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars by lending them more money than they could possibly repay and then taking over their economies. At 10, we'll hear part one of a series of programs on global warming from TUC Radio. It features Stanford professor of biology, Stephen Schneider, who gave the opening address at the Hadley Center conference on avoiding dangerous climate change on February 1st, 2005. Stephen Schneider is professor of biological sciences at Stanford University. At 10:30 on stage and studio, hear about Imago Theater's next production of Carol Churchill's Not Enough Oxygen. And later in the show, three women discuss their experiences with breast cancer. And at 11, it's Democracy Now!, featuring an excerpt from the recent debate between George Galloway and Christopher Hitchens. The two debate the Iraq invasion, Saddam Hussein, the Bush administration, Palestine, and more. Now we go to the first segment of the Radio Zine.
Good morning. This is Per Fogering, KABU News and Public Affairs. And our guest is John Perkins, who wrote a book that got quite a bit of attention, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. So let's get right into it. Right. Good morning, John. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Thank you. Good morning.
Okay.
Good to be with you.
Well, welcome to KABU.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, why don't we start out... Let's start out with just what does an economic hitman do?
Well, Per, I guess it's fair to say that over the past four decades, we economic hitmen have managed to create the world's first truly global empire. And it's been done primarily, for the first time in history, without the military, primarily. It's been done almost entirely through economics. Only the military only steps in as a last resort when everything else fails. And the way we do this takes many different forms, but perhaps the most typical one is that we will identify a country, a third world country, that has resources that our corporations covet, like oil, for example. And then we'll arrange a very large loan to that country. But most of the money will never go to the country at all. It'll go directly to a U.S. Construction company or one of our other big firms, like a Halliburton or a Bechtel that we've all heard about a lot these days, that will build infrastructure projects in that country, power plants, harbors, industrial parks, things that primarily serve the very rich and don't benefit the poor very much at all. And the country will then be left holding a huge debt. And it'll be such a large debt that there's no way the country can pay that back. So at some point in time, we economic hitmen go back to this country and we say, look, you owe us a lot of money. You can't repay your debt. So give us a pound of flesh. Sell your oil real cheaply to our oil companies, or vote with us on the next UN vote, or send troops in support of ours to someplace in the world, that sort of thing.
So like the U.S. is going to repossess the country or something, like a repo man.
Well, and we've been doing that, and we've been doing it very, very successfully around the world.
Well, from your book, it's like this: you were actually working for a private corporation, but it seemed to have a curious links with the U.S. government and the National Security Agency. Could you go into that a little bit?
Well,
how you were recruited for this?
Yeah, I was recruited by the National Security Agency, the nation's largest and probably least understood spy organization. I was recruited while I was still in college at Boston University Business School, but I ended up working for a private corporation, like you said, and that's the way these things are set up. It's also the way that the jackals are set up. Now, the jackals are people that go in on the few occasions when we economic hitmen fail. They're CIA-sanctioned assassins or people that overthrow governments. And these days, they don't work for the government directly either, unlike the James Bond movies. The days of the government-licensed agent to kill are long gone. These people now work for private corporations. And so both economic hitmen and jackals work for private corporations. And the reason that happens that way is twofold. One is that it alleviates having the government implicated if we're caught. And two, we have to understand that in a way, our government today is very much driven by our corporations. At the top of the heap, there's almost no separation. It's what I call the corporatocracy. So you've got men and women who move back and forth through what we call the revolving door policy all the time. So if somebody's a CEO of a major corporation, and then they become a cabinet minister in the government, or even vice president, or even president for that matter. And then when their term in government's over, they go back to work in the private industry. And so you really can't separate these people. And where they're very driven by corporate wealth, our government today really is very much the pawn of the big corporations.
Well, you know, some people say that this interlink between the corporations and the government is sort of the main definition of fascism.
I've heard that said, mm-hmm. too. I'm not an expert on fascism at all, so I can't comment on that, but it is certainly the way that our country is being managed today, unfortunately. I do not believe it's the way the Founding Fathers envisioned it. It certainly wasn't what I was grown up to believe was what the United States of America is all about.
Mm-hmm. So you were recruited, you worked for the National Security Agency, and then you applied for the National Security Agency?
I was recruited by them and went through a series of tests.
Mm-hmm.
Several days of tests, including lie detector tests and personality tests, and they identified me as potentially a good economic hitman. They also identified a number of weaknesses in my character, which they knew could be used as hooks to bring me into this. And I describe this in some detail in the book, but I think I can summarize those three weaknesses of character as kind of like the big three drugs of our culture: power, money, and sex.
So they used those then to kind of rope you in. Was there any kind of blackmail involved when you try to get out? Or?
Well, absolutely. That's always there. Now, the person who trained me for this primarily was a woman named Claudine, who again is described in detail in Confessions of an Economic Hitman. She was a very intelligent, a very beautiful, a very seductive, a very effective agent. And she knew all about me from the tests I'd gone through. She knew how to hook me. And she made it very clear that the business I would be getting into would be a dirty business, and that once I was in, I'd never be able to get out. And so I shouldn't go in unless I was committed to doing it. Now, she also made it clear that what I was going to do wasn't illegal. What economic hitmen do, for the most part, is not illegal. It should be illegal. But because we write the international laws, the World Trade Organization, World Bank, and those kinds of laws, we've made sure that these things are not illegal. If we were to do these on a personal level, there, for example, if I were to entice you, if I were a banker and I were to entice you into accepting a loan that I knew you couldn't pay because I wanted a favor from you in the future, I would be doing something illegal. But when that's done on an international level, it's not illegal,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately.
Well, you know, you have all these little... Actually, the banks do entice people, and, you know, they send them a credit card that's... all you have to do is call this 800 number, and you activate your card, and you got a $15,000 credit limit or something. And people have more than one of these, and now, you know, of course, now they got the bankruptcy laws changed, so it's hard to even go bankrupt anymore.
Well, I think we're coming close to that, and this is interesting. I think, you know, the types of things that we've been practicing in foreign countries, especially in third world countries, for the last four decades, we are now, and by we I mean the corporatocracy, are now beginning to see how successful those were in other countries, and we're implementing them in our own country. We're putting our own people into these same similar situations, as you just mentioned with the credit card. Perhaps a difference in that analogy is that the bank basically is putting you in a position where you keep paying, taking more and more loans and paying them higher and higher interest. They're probably, in most cases at least, not doing it because they're looking to get a favor from you later on. They are looking to get the interest back from you. The way we set this up with countries, the way economic hitmen do it, is we know that at some point that they cannot repay these loans and they can't pay the interest on them. And we don't even want to get the money back. What we want is to have them part of our empire. We want to get their oil or their tin or copper or diamonds or their vote in the UN or their support in a war, something along those lines that are really, in a way, much bigger than economic gains.
Well, you wonder if someday this country will ever have debtors' prisons again.
Well, yeah. How can we help it with the new laws that are going into effect? You know, what is going to happen to all these people?
Well, if the money system collapses, then what is there left to bargain away except your labor, I guess? But
and of course, we're living in a country that is the biggest debtor nation in the world. You know, we are essentially mm-hmm. bankrupt as a nation. We owe tremendous amounts of money to China, South Korea, and Japan, especially, and to many other countries too. We
yeah.
are a bankrupt nation.
Let's talk about that a little bit later. To me, I think it's very important. But now your first assignment, once you went to work for this company, now the company you actually worked for was Charles T. Maine. You know,
yes.
They're still around, I guess. I Googled them last night, and they seem to be still around.
You did, and you found them because they're not still around, actually. They were sold in 1984.
Oh, maybe it was old stuff then, but I saw it listed.
Really? Well, that's interesting. Maybe they've come back into being listed because of this book, because they've been getting a lot of attention recently. I don't know.
Well, there were stories about them. Now, maybe those are old stories. I should have looked a little harder, but it's a lot of it was just sort of financial stuff. But anyway, your first assignment was in Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
And Indonesia, of course, was a country that had a lot of oil. Although now I hear they're an oil importer. But anyway, what did you do in Indonesia?
It was kind of a classic example of where Indonesia at that time, this is the early 70s, was considered one of the dominoes. We knew at that point that we were losing the war in Vietnam. And there was this theory that it would be the domino effect. If Vietnam went, then the other countries of South Asia would go. And Indonesia was looked at as the kind of the key to stopping this process. And Indonesia also happened to have a lot of oil at that time. We didn't know how much exactly, but we knew it had a lot. And it had the largest Muslim population of any country in the world. So there were a number of reasons why we wanted to hook Indonesia and bring it into our fold as part of the empire. And so I was specifically sent there to convince the Indonesians that they should accept a very huge loan to build their electric system and an integrated system on the island of Java, which is their most populated island. And then we ended up in several other islands also. But the idea being that we would build these power systems, generating plants, transmission lines, and distribution lines that would feed big industries, not the poor people, mind you, but would feed the big industries that were owned by the most powerful people in Indonesia, bring them onto our side, make them happy, make sure that they were going to buy into our system, and at the same time essentially bankrupt the government of Indonesia, and, of course, give a great deal of work to our own companies in designing and building these systems.
So you did this kind of by fudging economic reports? Is that how it was done? Or?
Yeah, exactly. That's the right word. We fudged. We made a 25-year forecast of the economy and the demand for electricity, and we made them extremely high. We're looking at growth of around 20% a year, which is actually unheard of, even under anybody's standards. But we convinced everybody that that's what could happen in Indonesia if you built these power plants and transmission lines and distribution systems.
Yeah, and one theme that, and it kind of recurs in other countries, you know, you're sort of hobnobbing with these, you know, the rich and powerful people, but you were sort of compelled to go out in the streets and see how ordinary people lived, and it was pretty terrible.
Well, yes, I personally had been in the Peace Corps in South America, and I liked mixing with the people, and I was one of the few foreigners who bothered to learn Indonesian. I learned to speak Indonesian fairly fluently. And so I was very torn, you know. I was there to do this assignment, but I also really loved getting to know the people. I'd come up from a Peace Corps background, and so on my own I would go out and into the streets and get to know these people and visit their markets and their puppet shows, as I discussed in the book, and find out where their political thinking really was, which it didn't certainly help my conscience any, because as I got to know the people more, I could sympathize more with them and realize that what we were doing was a terrible thing. Under the guise of my job, what I needed to do was hobnob with the very rich and powerful in the country and help them. But I sort of on my own in the evenings and on weekends and time off would mix with the people.
Kind of like a double existence, almost.
Well, it really was. Mm-hmm. There's no question. I kept most of that activity of going out and meeting with people, especially when I kind of mixed with indigenous people. I was very interested in some of the things that they did, their ceremonies, and it's just been a fascination of mine since I was a little kid growing up in New Hampshire. I was very fascinated by the Abnaki and Algonquin people who lived in the area where I grew up. But, you know, if I told people at the World Bank I was doing this, they would have all thought I was a crazy hippie. And I didn't, you know, that wouldn't have helped me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really was living kind of a double life at that time, in a way, although certainly most of my life was aimed at being an economic hitman at that time.
So then after Indonesia, your next stop was Panama, is that right?
Yeah.
And what were you doing now? The Panama doesn't have any oil because they have the canal.
Yeah.
And you did you do the same thing there? You sort of got them to take out big loans, or
that was what I was supposed to do. And Panama is one of my failures. Omar Torrijos was the president of Panama at the time, and he was a very popular leader. He was he'd followed a long line of U.S. puppet governments. People that had been installed by us basically from the time we tore Panama away from Colombia back in the early 1900s so that we could build a canal. And Torrijos had taken over and was very popular among the poor. And I was supposed to bring him around because he was determined to get the canal back for Panama. And, of course, we didn't want to see that happen. So very soon after I got to Panama, Torrijos invited me to this little bungalow outside Panama City. And, again, this is described in detail in Confessions. And we sat there in this little bungalow, and he looked across the table at me, and he said, you know, I understand what your game is, and I know that if I play the game the way you want me to, Omar Torrijos will become fabulously wealthy. But that's not what I'm interested in. What I'm interested in is helping my poor people. So you can either play the game my way, or you can get the hell out of Panama. And I went back to my bosses in Boston and told them this, and we all decided we should stay in Panama because we could make some money as consultants there, and as long as we were there, there was a chance that we could bring Omar around. And so we went forward and did the things that he wanted us to do, which really were good for his people. This was one of the rare instances where the work I did really was helping poor people. But the problem was that I knew Torrijos was in trouble, because when the economic hitmen fail, and I was failing, the jackals step in, and the jackals try to overthrow governments, or they assassinate the heads of state. And we've seen this happen in Chile with Allende, and in Guatemala with Arbenz. We've seen it happen in Ecuador with Roldos. We've seen it happen in Iran with Mossadegh, and so on and so forth. And most recently, today, we've seen the attempt to make this happen in Venezuela against Hugo Chavez. But I knew that Omar Torrijos was very vulnerable. He was being watched by the whole world because he was standing up to the United States and demanding to get the canal back. And when a leader of a country like Panama stands up to us, it causes two problems. One is that we're not able to achieve our objectives, and two, it sets a precedent that we don't want to have established in the world. And so I very much feared for Omar Torrijos's life, and it was an added incentive for me to try to bring him around. I couldn't bring him around, and he was assassinated.
Right. That was in a helicopter crash? Was that
airplane crash, yes.
Airplane crash.
Mm-hmm.
Now, eventually, Panama did regain the canal, didn't they?
Well, before he was assassinated, mm-hmm. He was successful in negotiating the treaty with with Carter to bring the canal around. And our attempt at this point was to convince him and Panama that even though Panama could legally own the canal, that we would have control over it. And he wasn't going along with that. And another thing that he was doing was he was negotiating with the Japanese to build a sea level canal. The Panama Canal that we built is based on locks.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that, the largest ships in the world can't go through it.
Mm-hmm.
So the Japanese offered to finance and construct a new sea level canal that would take all the ships. And Torrijos was seriously negotiating with them. We were terribly opposed to this, and particularly some of our big corporations like the Bechtels and the construction companies were extremely opposed to this for obvious reasons. And so part of my job at this point was to really bring Torrijos around into our fold, but he didn't come. So he died.
Uh-huh. Could you tell some of the details of his plane crash?
Well, yeah, it was a small private plane, and he was flying from a fairly small town to a place, a farming community near where he had a place where he was going to be staying, and the plane blew up in midair.
Mm.
Now, after that, there were a lot of investigations that were done, and a number of the local investigators, of course, when the FBI did their investigation, they found that the plane blew up, nothing more. But there was a lot of evidence that at the last moment, and people had seen this happen, a security guard ran up to Torrijos and handed him a tape recorder. And the tape recorder had an explosive in it.
Mm-hmm. Is his son now president of Panama, or have I got that wrong?
No, you've got that right, Martin Torrijos. And he... unfortunately, not at all like his father. He's exploited the name, if you want to say that. But he's very much aligned with the old oligarchy that was in power before his father took over. And in fact, his vice president is a family member of that oligarchy. So, despite the fact that he has the same name and Omar was his father, this man who hardly knew his dad because he died when Martin was fairly young. Is not at all like him.
Mm. So Panama is sort of still in the grip of the old guards. The previous president was this woman. I can't think of her name, and she was kind of a corporate person too, wasn't she?
Well, yes. As soon as when Torrijos was assassinated, the next person to step up was Noriega.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought Noriega was our boy. You know, He'd been a CIA agent. He'd helped us with the drug wars in Colombia. He was a pretty corrupt and despicable character, honestly. And he'd received, according to documentation, millions of dollars from the CIA. And so we thought we had him in our pocket. But he also refused to renegotiate the canal treaty. And the attempt was made to renegotiate it and to soften it so that the U.S. would have more legal authority there. He refused to do that. He also refused to stop negotiating with the Japanese over the new canal issue. And at that point, it just so happened, coincidentally, that George Shultz, who had been Secretary of State, and Caspar Weinberger, who had been they had both been with Bechtel when all these negotiations were going on. They became Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, respectively. And at that point, the administration, this is the first Bush administration, put a tremendous amount of pressure on Noriega. He did not bend to the pressure. So we invaded in 1989.
Mm-hmm. I think he also was not doing his bid in the war against Nicaragua either.
That's been said, and it's been accused that that was the case. And it's also been said that he had a lot of pictures that had been taken on Contadora Island, which was a haven for corporate executives and politicians from the United States to go down and mix with beautiful women and drugs and sex and so on and so forth. There's a lot of rumors around, and it's very interesting. You know, he's still in prison in the U.S. and mm-hmm. basically incommunicado, so that it's very difficult for anybody to talk to him about anything. Makes you wonder. I don't know about that. That's all supposition as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. What I do know is that he refused to stop negotiating with the Japanese, and he refused to negotiate a new canal treaty. Those are facts. The rest, I don't know.
Well, we heard a lot that he was going to, you know, kind of blow the whistle on George Bush the Elder. Is he going to get out of prison sometime or what? Supposedly he's found Jesus while he's in prison.
Well, I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, that's what I heard. He's sort of become born again. But, you know, of course, he's very wisely hasn't said anything about his past life. But you think eventually he's going to get out of prison unless he meets a strange death in prison.
I doubt he'll ever get out of prison alive.
Really? Okay. Did you ever meet Noriega?
No.
Uh-huh. So then, okay, then later on you went to Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
And there you were involved, I guess, what the big project there was kind of recycling petrodollars?
Yeah, that was certainly an interesting one there. Because Saudi Arabia was unlike these other countries in that it didn't need to borrow money.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened in Saudi Arabia was a huge success from our standpoint, from the economic hitman standpoint. Back in the early 70s, as I well remember, and I don't know whether you're old enough to or not, but OPEC held back on oil. They were very upset with our policies in Israel. And so they basically shut down oil to this country. And we had long lines at gas stations. We were afraid we were going to go through another depression like that of the 1930s. And so the U.S. Treasury Department called me and some other economic hitmen in and said, look, you know, you got to come up with a plan so that we'll never be held hostage again by OPEC. Well, we knew that the key to any such plan was Saudi Arabia because it had more oil than any other country. And the House of Saud, the royal family, was corrupt and corruptible. So this would be where we'd go at it. And it's a fairly detailed deal that we worked out, and it's spelled out in detail in the book. But the summary version is that we came up with a deal, which the Saudis agreed to, whereby they would return most of the money that they earned from selling oil to the world to the U.S. and invest it in U.S. government securities. The interest from those securities would be given to the U.S. Treasury Department hire U.S. companies to go to Saudi Arabia and build up that country in the Western image, build power plants, desalinization plants, highways, in fact, build entire cities out of the desert. And the House of Saud would guarantee to keep the price of oil within limits acceptable to us, and we would guarantee to keep the House of Saud in power. And that deal has worked very, very well up until very recent times when it's beginning to fall apart because the House of Saud is so unpopular now, partly because they struck that deal. A lot of Muslims in the world are very, very upset with them for that, and partly because we now, it's pretty obviously, we're pretty powerless in the Middle East, and radical Islamic movements have gained a tremendous amount of power in the last few years. Well, so the deal's beginning to fall apart.
Well, there's also apparently, according to Matt Simmons, Saudi oil fields are getting seriously depleted. There's one huge oil field, Ghawar field, and apparently it's not producing like it did before. And so,
yeah, and you know, our whole oil policy has been based on the idea that at some point we would control Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait, and that gives us a pretty good guarantee of having a lot of oil. But so Saudi Arabia was certainly a big start in that direction, and then we figured if we could take over Iraq and then Iran, and we pretty much control Kuwait as long as we keep those other countries at bay, we would be able to control the world's largest oil supplies. It's not working out quite like that.
No, the wheels have come off that project, all right.
Yeah.
In fact, not too long, I think the year before last, some guy gave a lecture in the Pentagon about possibly just moving the military in there and taking over the oil fields.
Well, I think that's what we've tried to do, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
In Iraq.
Yeah, that's not worked. But then the Saudi fields, which are kind of pretty much located, along the Persian Gulf there. But in your book, you mention a sort of a mysterious envoy from the U.S. who kind of made the Saudis an offer they couldn't refuse. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, this is the deal that we put together, and then somebody had to present it to the House of Saud formally. And, I always and still fully believe that that was Henry Kissinger, although I don't have any inside information that says that. And whoever it was took this to the king, and he accepted. But then he put the burden kind of back on us that he had to have a unanimous vote on the part of the princes and his family, or some of the key princes. And so then one of my jobs was to bring one of those princes around so that he would vote in favor of this deal that we'd put together. But, it was all based on this meeting between some high-level official in our government and the king of Saudi Arabia, and I believe that official was Henry Kissinger.
And the other part of the offer was that if they didn't go along, bad things would happen.
Well, certainly. We had shown in Iran earlier that a democratically elected president, his name was Mossadegh, very, very popular, had stood up to our oil companies and said that he was going to tax us, tax the oil companies, and make sure that the Iranian people get their fair share of the oil taken out of their country. And when he did that, this is when we decided we had to get rid of him, even though he was a democratically elected premier. This is really the first real successful economic hitman. It was a guy named Kermit Roosevelt, who was a CIA agent. And he was Teddy Roosevelt's grandson. And he went into Iran with a few million dollars and managed to overthrow, stage coups and overthrow Mossadegh and replace him with the Shah of Iran. So when we went into the House of Saud, we certainly reminded them of what had happened to Mossadegh. And basically, we do this in all these countries. We'll go in and say, listen, to the leader of a country, listen, you can either make a lot of money by playing the game our way, or you can go the way of Mossadegh, or now Torrijos, or Noriega, or Arbenz, or Allende.
Mm-hmm.
That's
all
basically what I told Omar Torrijos when I met with him, too. Look, you can make a lot of money off this, or we'll get rid of you. And at that point, he said, I'm not interested in making a lot of money. You can either do it my way or get the hell out of Panama.
Mm-hmm. And then a lot of the money that went to the Saudis kind of wound up funding Al-Qaeda, too.
Well, that's for sure. Yes. I mean, it's a very interesting play of events around that. The money that went to the Saudis went to funding Al-Qaeda. The fact that the House of Saud made this deal with us, and now the most sacred sites of Islam, Mecca and Medina, are surrounded by petrochemical plants and McDonald's and all sorts of symbols of Western materialism, makes a lot of Muslims extremely angry. So what the House of Saud did, the deal they struck with us, accomplished a couple of things. One, it made Muslims around the world very, very angry. And two, it provided money that then the House of Saud passed on to many of the terrorist organizations.
In your book, then you say that Saddam Hussein was kind of offered the same kind of deal, but he didn't go for it.
No, if he'd taken the deal, he'd still be head of his country.
Mm-hmm.
We have to remember that, again, there was a president of Iraq named Qassem who, like Mossadegh in Iran, tried to clamp down on the oil companies, get them to pay taxes, pay their fair share to the Iraqi people, and we hired Saddam Hussein while he was still a high school student to assassinate Qassem.
Mm-hmm.
Missed. So uh-huh. We had Qassem executed, beheaded on public television in Iraq in the early 60s, and at that point put Saddam Hussein's family in charge. Saddam's cousin became head of state, and Saddam became the head of security and eventually rose to become head of state. And, of course, during the 60s and 70s, we sent billions of dollars to the Iraqis. We financed Saddam. We built in petrochemical plants, and we sold him many weapons for him to use against the Iranians, who had suddenly become our enemies, and against the Kurds and others. And we gave him, we lent him billions of dollars. And so in the 80s, we went back into him and said, look, you know, you need to play the same game as the Saudis. We tried to offer him the same deal, but he wouldn't accept. And so we sent in the jackals to assassinate him, but they couldn't get through to him. His security was very good, and he had a lot of doubles. So even his own security officers didn't know whether they were protecting him or some lookalike.
Mm-hmm.
And so we couldn't assassinate him. So in 91, the first President Bush sent in the military and wiped out his Saddam's army. Now, at that point, we certainly could have taken out Saddam, but we didn't want to, because he was a strong man. He was the type of guy we like having a country, running a country, as long as he's with us. And we figured he would be. He is the kind of guy that would stand up to the Iranians and the Kurds and others. And so we wanted to keep him in power. And we figured he'd been sufficiently chastised by having his military destroyed that now in the 90s he'd come around. So the economic hitmen went back to work. They couldn't bring him around. The jackals tried to assassinate him again. They couldn't. So once again, we sent the military in. Had Saddam come around the way the House of Saud did, he would still be running that country, and we'd be building him chemical plants and mm-hmm. biological plants and anything else he wanted.
Well, wasn't he about to sell oil for euros? Was that, make a big difference to him?
Yes, that certainly was another thing that aggravated us with him, is that not only did he not come around, but he threatened to basically expose us for the bankrupt nation that we've been in the process of becoming for some time now. You know, we can be the most indebted country in the world because we print the world standard currency,
mm-hmm.
dollar.
Right.
And as long as we have the authority to print the world standard currency, we can make it look as though we're in good shape, whether we are or not. But if an OPEC country, and if OPEC as a whole decided to accept a different currency as the standard, for example, the euro or the yen, and China or Japan or South Korea or a few other countries called in their debt to us, we'd be in deep, deep trouble. And Saddam was making sounds as though he was in the process of trying to make that happen.
Well, now Iran apparently is going to open up an oil market next year, and they're going to accept euros and other currencies.
Well, that'll be very interesting to see what happens there. And, of course, we've got something similar happening in our back door with Venezuela, with Hugo Chavez, who's mm-hmm. very upset at the United States and is our fourth largest oil seller to us, and now is, you know, negotiating very actively with the Chinese, perhaps to sell oil in yen.
But then they had to build a pipeline across Colombia, and I wonder how secure that would be.
Well, no, Venezuela has big ports of its own. It would simply mean the tankers have to go, the big tankers can't go through the Panama mm-hmm. Canal, but they can go around the southern tip of Africa or South America. It's a mm-hmm. little longer, but they can do it.
I'd heard they were going to build a pipeline across Colombia to some Pacific port.
Well, there's been a lot of talk about that, mm-hmm. too. That's always a possibility.
But I wonder if Saddam will kind of spill the beans when he goes on trial. I guess he's going to go on trial tomorrow. Of course, there'll probably just sort of be a little arraignment, and the trial won't begin until another month or so. But, his first job with the CIA, he was hired to assassinate General Qassem, and that assassination failed. And then the CIA, from what I read, they got him out of Baghdad, and they got him to Beirut and then Cairo, and he kind of hung around Cairo playing dominoes and going to law school, of all things, and hanging out at the embassy.
Mm.
And then later on, the Ba'ath Party did overthrow General Qasem, and they executed him. And then, of course, then the U.S. gave the Ba'ath Party a list of leftists to kill, very much like they did in Indonesia later on.
Yeah. Yeah, it's happened in so many places. You've got your history down real good, Per. I'm glad to hear it. That's great.
Well, I got interested in, you know, after the Dodgers left Brooklyn, I stopped getting involved with baseball statistics. So. you also, there's a very interesting thing you say about Ecuador. I mean, they have oil, too, and another president was assassinated there, Jaime Roldos.
Correct.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
It was almost the same time, actually. He was assassinated about 3 months before Torrijos, and I also was trying to bring Roldos around, another failure, and he was extremely committed to his people. Now, he was the first democratically elected president after many years of dictators, again, U.S. puppet dictators, and he ran on a ticket that was very strongly opposing exploitation of his country by the oil companies, again saying that he would pass a Hydrocarbons Act that would make sure that his people get their fair share of money from oil that was taken out of the country. And he won by a landslide. Immediately after he won, we economic hitmen went in and tried to cut deals with him. And again, you know, we let him know, listen, you know, you can make a lot of money personally if you go along with us. If you don't, you're out of here. And he would not go along with this. So he, too, died in a fiery plane crash, very much like Torrijos.
Mm-hmm. And he was succeeded by some pretty strange presidents. Bucaram was one, the name comes to mind, and then Gutierrez. Now, he just came back to, he was actually kind of thrown out of office by uprising among the people, and then now he's back in Ecuador. Is he under house arrest or something, or what?
Well, Gutierrez is a fascinating example of what's going on today.
Mm-hmm.
In the last major elections throughout South America, six major countries have voted in the president that ran on an anti-U.S., anti-World Bank, anti-corporatocracy ticket. This happened in Argentina, Chile, Uruguay, Venezuela, and Ecuador. And every one of these, it represents about three-quarters of the, and I forgot to mention Brazil, it's a really big one.
Mm-hmm.
These countries represent about three-quarters of the population of South America. They sent a very, very strong notice to the American people that they are extremely unhappy with the way we're conducting business in that part of the hemisphere. But the problem is, as soon as one of these presidents gets in, an economic hitman walks into his office and says, look, you know, here in my left pocket, I got a couple of $100,000 for you and your family if you play the game. In my right pocket, I got a gun with a bullet with your name on it.
Mm.
Now, and if you don't play the game, so if you're one of these presidents, what are you going to do? You know, you could be the most integritous person in the world, but you're saying, my God, you know, and I saw it happen to Allende, I saw it happen to Roldos, I saw it happen to Arbenz, I saw it happen to Torrijos, and, you know, I've seen it happen, I saw it happen to Qasem, I saw it happen to Mossadegh, you know, it's happened around the world. And these guys are serious. So you say to yourself, you know, what am I going to do? And in the case of Gutierrez, within a month after he was elected, there's a famous picture that was shown all over Ecuador and him holding hands with George Bush. He'd flown up to Washington. And the economic hitmen were in there all the time with him. He came around.
Mm-hmm.
And he went against everything that he had run for. He began to cut very, very sweet deals with the oil companies. He went up against the indigenous people who were very strong in Ecuador, about 40% of the population, and they'd supported him and expected him to protect their lands against the oil companies. He did not do that. And so there were tremendous rebellion in Ecuador, and they overthrew him. They threw him out of the country, basically, and replaced him with his vice president, Palacio. And I have very good friends in Ecuador. I spent a lot of time in that country, and, you know, they told me, you know, we are practicing democracy. When you elect a president who runs on a certain platform and then he totally opposes that platform once he gets in office, democracy calls for getting rid of him. That's what we've done.
Mm-hmm. Now, is Palacios, how is he doing? Is he standing up for the people, or is he caving in also?
Well, so far he appears to be standing up for the people. Mm-hmm. He's a medical doctor. He spent many years in the United States, trained here. He's not a radical person by any means. In fact, most people consider him politically conservative. But he's saying the people have spoken, and I'm their elected official. I'm going to stand up for them. There are elections coming up this next year, and we'll see what happens. We'll also see what happens to him, because one can only imagine the kind of pressure that's being put on him right now. He's getting that same message. Play the game our way, and you'll get rich. Oppose us, and you'll be thrown out or killed.
Kind of like that offer that was reportedly made to the Taliban in Germany, where some U.S. person said, something like, give you carpets covered with gold, or we'll carpet bomb you, or something like that.
Well, you know, what it says to me, Per, is that the responsibility lies with us, the American people.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have a tremendous opportunity to do something. I think there's a lot of anger in our own country, and we're beginning to understand the fact that my book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, has been on the bestseller list for a long time. It was on the New York Times for about 20 weeks. It's been an amazing popular success, way surpassing anything I ever expected. And I think that and a number of other factors indicate that a lot of Americans are finally beginning to understand the situation in the world, and we're not liking it. And we're seeing this taking us down a road that's going to be very, very bad for our children.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think there's an opportunity here, and the change has to come from us. The Latin Americans, for example, have spoken. You know, they elected these candidates, and the candidates were bold, and they ran on very strong anti-American tickets. But once they're in office, the only people that can help them stay in office is you and me, is us in the United States. We have to demand of our government that it play hands off. It doesn't matter whether I like Hugo Chavez or Lula of Brazil or any of the others, or whether I believe in their policies, or whether I think they're corrupt or whatever. If they're elected democratically in those countries, and even if they oppose U.S. oil companies and U.S. interests, we have no right to try to throw them out as we've done or assassinate them. And we in the United States must stand for the principles that our Constitution upholds, and we must stand up, and we must insist that our government and our corporations take their hands off these democratically elected officials.
Oh, a listener called in. He's asking about was there any involvement of the U.S. in Libya in getting rid of King Idris and placing Gaddafi in power?
You know, I have no personal experience in Libya, and I don't like to speculate. I like to talk about places where I've really worked.
I don't know either. I mean, Gaddafi's sort of a strange guy. Sometimes he seems to be very, he jumps sides a lot.
Yeah.
But, can this anger or outrage from the people rise and change things at the upper levels of government? I mean, the American people are pretty fed up with a lot of things going on, but can they really change things at the top? I guess that's an ongoing question.
Well, I believe we can, and I wouldn't have written a book if I hadn't, Per, because in a way I knew I was sticking my head in the noose when I wrote that book, and I'm not suicidal, and I wrote it because I think that once the American people really know what's going on in the world, we'll demand to do it better.
Mm-hmm.
We have the resources today, of all kinds of resources, financial, creative, spiritual, so on and so forth, to really make this a much more egalitarian world across the world, to realize the American principle of the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness for all people. And that's how we're going to make this a safe place for our children. It isn't going to be by sending troops to foreign lands to support our oil companies. It isn't going to be by cheating countries and putting them in deep debt. It's going to be by being compassionate, by being what we really say we are and what we as Americans really believe we are. And I think we're beginning to understand that. Mm-hmm. Throughout our history, you know, we've been able to create tremendous change. You know, look at the anti-smoking campaign. look at the campaigns to protect, to restore rivers that were burning across this country because they were so badly polluted. 100 years ago, women didn't have the right to vote. 30 years ago, blacks didn't ride on the same buses as whites in many parts of the South. We've changed all that because we recognized there was a problem, and we motivated ourselves to change it. Now, until recently, we haven't recognized this world situation as a problem. We have not understood that the corporatocracy has created an empire. Most Americans don't understand that. They don't understand why people around the world are so angry at us. And I believe that once we really understand that, radio shows like yours are helping to educate people. And once people really begin to understand that, we will demand change. And when we demand change long enough and hard enough, we'll get it.
You know, one thing that happened in Ecuador, as I recall, was that the dollar became their currency.
Yeah.
Is that still in effect, and how did that happen?
Well, that's still in effect. We insisted on it. It was one of those reforms that we worked with the World Bank and IMF to insist that that happened. And it was a terrible mistake for the poor people and a huge boon for the wealthy. So the day before the sucre, which is was the old currency, before the sucre was dollarized, as they would say, the day before, it was you could buy $1 for about 15,000 sucres, and the day after, it cost you 25,000 sucres.
Mm-hmm.
So if you happen to have money in dollars, like the wealthy people of Ecuador did, you made out like a bandit, and like the U.S. corporations did. If you happen to be holding sucres and needing to convert them to any other currency, or it just in the local market, things just skyrocketed in price. So what you thought you had a dollar if you had 15,000 sucres, and the next day you needed 25,000, almost double, to have a dollar. And so the wealthy people and the big corporations all had their money in dollars already.
Mm-hmm.
And so this whole process served to help the oligarchies, the very wealthy people who are on our side, and it also helped our corporations and our oil companies tremendously.
Well, you wonder if something like that will happen to the dollar if China dumps the dollar, some other currency replaces it, because in a sense is that the U.S. is sort of writing these bad checks, but other countries have to accept them because that's why they buy their oil.
Yeah, well, that's the standard currency, but like you said, that could change. If OPEC went on the yen standard or the euro standard, we'd be in very, very deep trouble. And, as we talked about earlier, that's one of the other reasons we invaded Iraq.
So what would happen? I mean, prices would go up, I guess, because the dollar is worth very little. There'd be huge inflation. Some people say that's how the U.S. will get out of its debt, by sort of inflating its way out. But, then you look what happened to Germany in the 20s.
Well, it was something very similar could happen to us as to what happened to Germany in the 20s. And some of my European friends have said, maybe that's exactly what the corporatocracy here wants. So we'll get a new Hitler running this country.
Oh boy!
That's speculation. I do not subscribe to that one. But mm-hmm. I've heard that's rumored in Europe.
Well, I hear that too. Strangely enough, but I don't know what other way. How else would the U.S. Get out from under this debt?
It's not, we have to bite the bullet.
That's the only way.
I mean, mm-hmm. Our politicians. We're not going to get out of it, and we're not going to save ourselves as a nation unless we get some leaders that step forward and are brutally honest with us,
mm-hmm.
and tell us, look, the world's in dire straits, and the U.S. is in dire straits, but we can fix it. But one of the ways we have to fix it is to radically increase taxes, particularly on corporations. Corporations today are getting away with murder, basically, from a tax standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
They're paying something like 10%. Taxes or less, and there have been times in our history when they were paying up to 50%, like during World War II. So they're not carrying their own load. In fact, in the last 3 years, the majority of our biggest, most profitable corporations haven't paid any taxes, or they've paid even less because they've gotten credits. And a lot of that is because they, you know, work out of other countries that are called tax haven countries, and we allow that to happen. You know, the only way we're going to get out from under this is to really admit that we've got a serious problem and to say, look, we're going to bite the bullet for the sake of our children and our grandchildren. We're going to start paying the debt that we all owe today. And, of course, the biggest burden should fall upon the richest people and upon the corporations.
Sure, they got the benefits of it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's a lot of talk these days, but, you know, about debt relief for the poor nations. I mean, is that for real, or is it just kind of window dressing?
It's the biggest scam that the economic hitmen have come up with.
Really?
Those 18 nations that have been listed as ones, and then there's another 22 that are on standby, as I understand it. But in the last 5 years or so, every one of those nations has been told that their conditionality, that's the word that's used by the World Bank, conditionality that they have to meet in order to have this debt reduction. And those 18 have agreed to those conditionalities. Those include privatization of all their state-owned or government-owned organizations like the utility companies and telephone companies and power companies and schools and prison systems and all of that, which basically means selling all those assets to foreign companies, primarily U.S. companies. And it also it involves things that we call good governance, which basically means they can't protect any of the products that they produce there through tariffs, et cetera. But they have to accept the tariffs that we have in this country. So there's a lot of trade barrier issues. And only when they accept these conditionalities are they put in a position where they could be forgiven of the debt. Now, I'm all for debt forgiveness, but it shouldn't have any conditionalities attached to it.
Right.
And certainly they shouldn't have to privatize these civil service sectors of their economy.
Sounds like the World Bank is taking over your old job.
Well, that was always the scheme. You know, we were in there as sort of a private people who were using the bank as a tool, and in the process, the bank was becoming becoming the tool itself, if you will.
Well, we're near the end of our hour. We've been talking with John Perkins, who wrote a book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Do you have a website that people can stay in touch with?
Yeah, they can. There's a couple of them. They can go to johnperkins.org or a nonprofit organization that I created a number of years ago called dreamchange.org.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being with us. It's been a fascinating hour, and I really recommend this book. It's quite a book, and it really kind of gets people see the way this world global system works from the inside. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Well, you're welcome, Per, and thank you for bringing all these things out into the light. It's programs like yours that'll save democracy if we're going to save it.
Well, let's hope so. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, this is Per Fogring. It's 9:58, and I'm not sure. I don't have a list of what's coming up next. Oh, okay. Our engineer tells me that she'll tell you what's coming up next, but I know it'll be good. I know Democracy Now! Is on at 11. So anyway, stay tuned.
I just want to say the name of the book by John Perkins is Confessions of an Economic Hitman, or is that right? Now I'm trying to look it up. Oh, well, hold on a sec. Yeah, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, John Perkins.